The kids saw where the country was at, a crossroads, maybe the most important one in its history. They knew how big the stakes here were. Please, God, help me not to let them down, Buckland prayed. He was putting away his pen when he felt the index card in his inside jacket pocket. He pulled it out. On the card, there was a marker drawing of an evil Knievel-looking guy on a USA motorcycle jumping a bald eagle with the following message. Dear Dad, you're my hero. Putin is a zero. Ha ha. Love, your son, Terrence. Buckland laughed. What is it? Huxley Laffer said. He showed her the card. Huxley Laffer chuckled. What am I doing here? You already have an excellent advisor, sir. I hope the rest of the world agrees with you, Terrence, Buckland thought, tapping the card against the bulletproof window as the car began to roll. Chapter 91. At exactly 11:50 a.m., a 32-year-old UPS driver named Howard Navarro was standing on the street at the back of his brown box truck, double parked on the avenue side of the southeast corner of 72nd and Lexington Avenue. Loading packages on his hand truck, he suddenly heard a shriek of air brakes and jumped back as a massive, grumbling blue dump truck passed by on his right so close that it knocked his passenger side mirror askew. You stupid frickin' meathead, are you kidding me? Said Navarro, as he hurried forward toward the dump truck, stopped now at the red light. Navarro squinted as he noticed right away that there was something off about the driver. Up there, behind the closed window, the guy just sat there, expressionless and unmoving. It was some strange-looking black dude with dreads and aviator sunglasses under a light blue hard hat. Yo, what are you, stoned? Navarro said as he banged on the guy's door. I'm talking to you! As if in response, the truck pulled immediately forward through the intersection, almost running over Navarro's feet as the light turned green. Lexington Avenue rolled by smoothly outside the truck's windshield. Taxis went past on both sides. Parked cars and city buses, pedestrians on the sidewalk, a Gristides on the left, a Sparrow on the right. Buildings got noticeably nicer as the truck, picking up a little speed now, arrived at the mid-60s. Sidewalk awnings began to appear on apartment houses, as well as flags and doormen outside hotels. The dump truck had been getting a bunch of green lights at each of the cross streets, but on 60th, it went through a yellow. A block later, at 59th, it rolled on through a just-turned red, almost clipping a guy in surgical scrubs by the corner, talking on his phone. Whoopsie, the assassin's wife said in the vestibule of the bank, where she was piloting the remote-controlled dump truck with her smartphone. Far in the distance on her screen, she could see the flashing lights of the president's motorcade passing right to left through the Lexington Avenue intersection at 52nd Street. Shit, 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 she mumbled. Was she too late? With a swipe of her thumb, she steered the truck into the center lane and dropped the hammer. In a blur, 58th Street went by, then 57th, 56th, 55th. On her screen, she read the remote speedometer. The massive truck in its top gear now was hurtling at an incredible 73 miles an hour. It was all about math now, math and physics, she thought, as she blasted the truck through the wooden sawhorse detour at 54th Street like a runaway freight train. Two blocks and closing, she swallowed, her thumb down on the accelerator. This was going to be very close. On her screen, at the intersection of 52nd and Lexington, she could now clearly see the rapidly closing white sides of the massive city sanitation trucks that were being used to protect the intersections along the entire motorcade's route. But instead of T-boning a sanitation truck, she flicked the control with her thumb again, and the blue dump truck suddenly lurched and moved hard left. straight toward the front doors of 599 Lexington Avenue on the corner of 53rd Street. 599 Lexington was one of those massive midtown office buildings that are practically a whole block wide, and because of this, they have lobbies that pass through the full length of the building. 599 Lex's lobby was unique, as it actually crossed the block in a diagonal from the southeast corner of 53rd and Lex to a quarter block east of 52nd and Lex. Directly out in front of the building's entrance, the hell-bent for leather speeding dump truck bounced up like it was about to do a wheelie as it smashed up off the high curb. Then, as it bucked down on the sidewalk, its 25 tons of rolling steel ripped through a sidewalk city bike rack like it was tissue paper and burst through 599 Lexington's doors and glass wall with a breathtaking, eardrum-crushing smash of pulverized glass. Sparks and an ungodly grinding sound roared from its steel dump bed sides as it rode the interior lobby's left-hand marble wall. It ate the lobby security desk in a splintering explosion of mahogany, then continued its hurtle down the marble interior concourse, pouring off plumes of smoke and dust behind it like a square steel meteor. The massive truck rocketed toward the presidential motorcade, which could clearly be seen now, passing obliviously by on the side street through the glass wall just beyond the lobby's far end. Chapter 92. The governor of New York's smartphone, as well as his wife, Janet, flew forward into President Buckland's lap as the presidential limo screeched to a sudden dead stop. Buckland, in shock, looked down at the governor's wife, whom he now suddenly held in his arms, and then looked forward out through the limo's windshield, trying to believe what he was seeing. A moment before, there had been a terrible sound off to the left like metal ripping. Then a massive blue dump truck had emerged, impossibly, out of the side of a glass office building on the left and punched through the pedestrian sidewalk barriers, smashing a direct hit into the dummy limo directly ahead of them. The hurtling truck had T-boned the dummy limo's center mass and flipped it up and over onto its side and sent it spinning up on the south sidewalk. The truck's momentum had carried it straight through the opposite sidewalk's barrier, and it now sat embedded in the front of a restaurant. Through the rising dust, Buckland could see that the cab of the truck was in flames. One of the steel walls of the dump truck's bed had become detached and was quivering back and forth like a just-used diving board. As he watched, the tailgate it was attached to ripped free and fell into the street with a hollow clang. "Move back!" screamed Secret Service agent Luke Foldiger to the driver as he somehow leaped through the open driver's partition and into the rear of the limo and pulled the governor's wife out of Buckland's lap. "Are you hurt, sir?" Foldiger said. A high-pitched metallic radio twerping was coming from the dashboard as the limo began reversing, its tires squealing. "Is Bronco injured?" Agent Kellett yelled from the front seat, not waiting for an answer. "Hotel 7, we have contact, we have contact. 52nd between Lex and 3rd. Kellett hollered into his radio. "Do you hear me?" I'm fine," Buckland said. "That's a negative. Bronco is secure," Foldiger said to Kellett. There was more radio chatter, and then horns and sirens were honking outside in the street. The blasting and bleeding were head-splitting, like the heralding of the end of the world. Buckland turned in his seat and could see that they were reversing the entire convoy. Through the blur and motion, he could also see people on the street and sidewalk standing frozen in sheer panic. People everywhere with hands to their mouths, standing as still as model people in a train layout. He put his hands to his own mouth, wondering suddenly if this was it, if he would die now. His mind cleared of everything except how much he missed his wife. "Where to now? Back to the hotel?" Buckland said as he heard the governor's wife start weeping. "Negative. The situation is too volatile, sir," Foldiger said, as the limo did a hard, sliding lurch to the left and pinned it up Lexington. We are going to go to our fallback, Sanctuary One.
Sanctuary One? Asked Huxley Laffer.
Park Avenue Armory, man. That's our fallback position. You'll all be safe there until we get this thing sussed out.
Chapter 93. 30 seconds before the impact, we had heard a blast of sudden screaming chatter on the radio. From the Black Hawk hovering over 57th and Lex, we had actually witnessed the whole scene unfold. The blue dump truck crashing through the barrier on 54th, and then hurtling down Lex toward the 52nd Street motorcade route like a bat out of hell.
Once the dump truck had swerved at 53rd and entered the building, I thought the driver was ditching it, that it was over. But when I saw the truck exit the other side of the block-wide building at 52nd and smash through the sidewalk barrier into the first limo, my hands went to my mouth, and all I could hear was someone on the radio crying, "No! No! No!" The next long minute reminded me of 9/11, that same helpless, terrifying feeling of how something impossible can be happening right before my very eyes, as smoke and dust billowed up out of the narrow slot of the Manhattan street. An absolute chaos of radio chatter and people screaming followed. When it subsided a little, we got the word. It had been the dummy limo. LaRue beside me gave me a painful high five. Buckland was fine. We were immediately assigned to provide air cover as Buckland was transferred to Park Avenue Armory at 67th Street, the pre-designated secure area. We zipped up and then tilted down over the MetLife building just in time to see the presidential limo come out in reverse from beside the Waldorf and haul ass north up Park Avenue. It was a truly terrifying sight. The limo had only two SUVs flanking it. At every cross street, it seemed like some new threat would suddenly emerge, another truck, or who knew what the hell else. "They're going to take Bronco in through the back southwest corner of 67 and Lex," LaRue told me, as we came to a still hover over the massive castle-like building that was Park Avenue Armory. I vaguely remember that the old red brick building was used for art shows and events now, but it had, in the Civil War era, been a barracks that housed horses and soldiers. "Look sharp, Mike. I got 7 to 11. You take from 1 to 5. LaRue said to me as he got on his spotting scope. "Remember, anything up to 2,000 yards. Under the hard flutter of the rotors, I stared down at the limo, then out at the Upper East Side's daunting number of surrounding buildings, the rooftops and terraces, and window after window after window.
Chapter 94. 511 yards and 140 feet above the corner on 67th Street, the British assassin lay prone on his elevated shooting platform, breathing calmly, stilling himself. He'd removed the glass of the living room window, and he was happy for the cold air that blew in and cooled the sweat on his brow. In front of the now glassless window was a decorative Asian bamboo folding partition, and above it was the valance of a curtain covering the top of the window. In between the two was his blind's offset shooting slit. He could shoot down through the slit without being spotted from the outside. The British assassin thought that, with its highly varnished walnut stock and blue steel barrel, the L39A1 Enfield English sniper rifle up on the small tripod before him was a glorious Stradivarius of a gun. It was loaded with 10 soft-point .303 caliber British rounds, a favored cartridge of choice for many deer hunters because of its high twist rate and excellent penetration. The locked and loaded bolt-action rifle had been fitted with what was simply the finest high-precision rifle scope in all the world, a German-made Schmidt & Bender PM2. He didn't know if it was an intentional nod to the bloody medieval history of the Fatherland or something, but to him, the intricate mill marks along the S&B's reticle gave it the distinct look of an elaborate Gothic cross. The red intersection of that cross was dead centered now on the sidewalk at the southwest corner of 67th and Lexington. To the left of the reticle was the armory's rear doorway, and to the right was the just-arrived limousine of the President of the United States of America. To be precise, the scope was zeroed in 69 inches up above the corner, just a skosh under Buckland's 6'1 height. The protective agent would come out and open the limo door and allow the President onto the curb first, the British assassin knew. The moment Buckland stepped from the street onto the sidewalk would be exactly when he was going to drop him with a headshot. One shot, center mass, just above Buckland's left ear, would shear the entire top of his head clean off. The greatest assassination in the history of the world, after all, deserved nothing less than a one-shot, clean kill. The preparation was over, the windage determined, the elevation adjustments calculated. As he lay there, certainty came to him, as if it had all been recorded already in the history books. The sniper who wouldn't quit, they would call him, the ultimate professional, the greatest shot who ever lived. Chapter 95. Low above Park Avenue Armory in the trembling helicopter, LaRue and I frantically did a systematic visual search of the surrounding windows and rooftops. The President's limo was there below us on the southwest corner of Lex. We had word that the President was still inside it. They had cordoned off 67th between Park and Lex, and the bullet and bomb-proof vehicle had been determined to be the safest place for him until the situation on the street was better put under control. It was the strangest thing. I don't know if the attack on the motorcade had been tweeted or something, but there was now about a couple hundred people on the side street and avenue sidewalks near the limo. Most of them seemed to be students from Hunter College, located not far from the armory. Were they trying to get selfies, I wondered? Just bizarre. Thank God a bunch of uniformed cops from the 19th precinct halfway down 67th had arrived to deal with it, but it was still quite a volatile, kinetic scene. I swung my spotting scope down to the street toward a sudden surge in the crowd surrounding the limo. You've got to be kidding me, I thought. The cops were trying to arrest some dreadlocked white boy who had gotten too close to the limo. Now was no time for a sit-in. Where the hell were the rest of the Secret Service people to take care of this circus, I wondered. It was becoming a riot down there. Just as I wondered it, I caught something in the edge of my scope down there on the street. On the northwest corner of Lex, opposite the President's limo, among the crush of students, there was a tall, preppy guy in an overcoat standing beside the pillar of the Hunter College building. It was Matthew LaRue's CIA boss, Mark Evrard.
Matt, 3 o'clock, on the corner. Is that Evrard? That's your boss, right? Yeah, it is,
LaRue said, looking down through his own scope.
That's weird. I thought he said he was heading back down to D.C.
I had a strange feeling right then, staring down at Evrard. He just looked wrong, out of place, foreboding. Everything was moving around him, but he was as still as the post he stood beside. Then, something in the back of my mind shifted and knocked against something else. This was really no time to be checking my phone, but I checked it anyway. I opened the message from Doyle that had been sent sometime in the last 10 crazy minutes.
Mike, we did it. The link to Levkov.
Here's a video still of the SUV off a camera at the nearest gas station in Yonkers. Witness has already ID'd. These are the guys who dumped Levkov's body. I tapped the photo and nodded my exploding head. I looked down at the corner, then at the photo, then down at the corner again. In the photo was Evrard. Mark Evrard with that goon of a driver I had met the night I followed LaRue from the gallery. I didn't know why, but it was Evrard. Evrard was behind the whole thing. The man behind the curtain. Evrard had hired the assassin. But he was here now. Why? The attempt at the motorcade had failed. Because here and now was here and now, I realized. The assassin's intent was to get the president to the armory all along. We had no time. It was about to happen.
They're about to bring the president out.
The pilot called back to us.
No!
I screamed.
No, tell them not to. Tell them to leave him in the car. What's the matter? What's going on?
Said LaRue anxiously, still focused on the limo.
It's Evrard. He killed Levkov. He's the one behind everything. Are you sure? This is the photo of the guys who killed Levkov.
I said, showing LaRue my phone.
You mean? Yes,
I said.
He set you up. He set all of us up.
I pointed my spotting scope at the street. Down on the corner, Evrard was looking east down 67th, then looking up. He glanced at the presidential limo as he took out his cell, checking something. Then he looked back east, back up.
Matt, watch Evrard. He's looking up. East up 67th, he keeps looking up.
LaRue lifted the Secret Service radio.
This is Air Cover One. We have a problem on the outside of the vehicle. Do you copy? Keep Bronco in the vehicle. Copy.
We listened to the radio. There was nothing. There was just static, white noise.
Hey, can you get them?
LaRue yelled up to the pilot.
No, it's not working,
he said.
Nothing. They're jamming the signal or something.
I cried as I looked frantically up 67th Street with the spotting scope.
They're going to kill him now. I see it, I see it,
I said a second later.
That white building, farthest window on the right, two floors down. See how the other windows in the building have a sun glare on them? But that one doesn't have any. He must have taken out the glass.
I zeroed in tighter with my scope zoom. Instead of shades or blinds in the window, there was some kind of Chinese screen and a little curtain. Between them were what looked like the aluminum legs of a ladder or a painter's scaffold. That's when I remembered the sniper's blind in the MetLife building. The shooter had been up high, near the ceiling of the space, far back to get a downshot angle on the street. When I took my eye off the scope, I saw LaRue pounding on the shoulder of the pilot.
Down! Down! Put me on the roof of the armory!
Chapter 96. Because of the raised structures on the armory's roof, the helicopter could only get us to about 10 feet above it. We had to hang off the sides and jump, and I went first. It was farther down than I'd anticipated, and I'd landed off balance and went over onto the rough tar paper, the breath knocked out of me. I was standing, looking up, waiting for LaRue to follow when his sniper rifle fell out of the chopper's side door and clattered to the rooftop beside me. What the hell, I thought, looking down at it. Then I looked up again and saw LaRue himself drop sideways out of the helicopter, crashing hard onto the roof. I'm shot, he said as he clutched himself with both bloody hands above his groin. What? I thought. It was unbelievable. Impossible. Just like that? I saw the muzzle flash, he gasped as blood began to pool out onto the tar paper beneath him. It was from the window, the one you spotted. Medic, help! I yelled up at the chopper. No time, LaRue said as I knelt to help him. He took one of his blood-covered hands off his wound and pointed toward the huge sniper rifle. If you don't get help, you're gonna die, Matt. No, the president is. You have to save the president, he said. But there's no buts, he screamed, his face clotted with pain. Get over to that corner of the roof and drop that son of a bitch. Shoot the bastard. I ran across the roof with the rifle. At the corner of the crazy old building was an actual battlement like you'd see on the top of a rook chess piece. I set the huge rifle into the battlement's chest-high indentation and looked up through the scope. Even at this lower angle, I still couldn't see the shooter in the window. Just the crazy Chinese screen, the little curtain, the ladder and the gap between them. There was no target. I glanced down to the street as a roar came from the crowd. It was the president's limo. One of the Secret Service agents was at its rear, opening the door.
No! Get back!
I screamed, but I knew it was fruitless. He couldn't hear me over the crowd in chopper rotor wash. There was no more time. Do or die. I looked back up at the glassless window 2 blocks to the east, and I knelt as I put the rifle to my shoulder. Chapter 97. In one oiled piston-like motion, the British assassin cleared the brass casing of the bullet with which he had just gut-shot the cop out of the chopper and reclosed the Enfield rifle's blue steel bolt. He'd been alternating his aim from the limo to the chopper from the moment it arrived. He didn't know how the sniper team had spotted him, but they had. When he had looked back up from the limo a moment before, the two-man team had both of their scopes on him. Reorienting on his target, he watched in the scope as the other cop scurried and ducked behind one of the armory roof's battlements a split second before the British assassin was going to blow his brains out. Smart man, he thought. Run for your life. When he looked back down at the limo, there was a Secret Service agent at its rear, ready to open the door. Buckland was coming out. There still was a chance. The British assassin adjusted the Enfield a millimeter down as the president stood up from behind the limo door and stepped onto the sidewalk. He sucked in his breath, held it. Just as he slipped the center of the Gothic cross reticle onto Buckland's head, he saw the muzzle flash from the armory's roof. The .408 caliber Chi-Tac round, traveling at 3,500 feet per second, came in at him just under his own rifle. As it struck home, it cut a perfectly circular groove through the bones of the ring and pinky fingers of his left hand holding the Enfield stock. Then it bored a perfect quarter-size hole through the center of his chest cavity and blew his spine and heart and much of his back out across the wall behind him. Epilogue. Chapter 98. A week later, Old Glory snapped in the wind along with the coattails of the Honor Guard, standing out on the grass as the marching band played the national anthem. When it was established that we had, in fact, somehow managed to still keep our flag waving o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave, at least for the time being, there was much hooting and cries of, let's go, from the field and the stands. We were at Fordham Prep's famous homecoming turkey bowl game against Xavier, and Mary Catherine and Seamus and all my kids and I went nuts as Brian and Marvin took the field with the rest of the Rams for the kickoff.
Well, they made it, the two knuckleheads, despite all their own efforts to the contrary, Seamus said.
I shook my head. I didn't want to even think about what could have happened to them once I got into the bottom of the saga of Marvin and Brian and the drug dealer. Sometimes if you're wise and like to sleep at night as a parent, you say, all's well that ends well, and leave it at that. Which is exactly what I did say as I handed Seamus and Mary Catherine brimming plastic cups. After I clicked cups with two of my 12 favorite people in the world, I took a long, much-deserved sip out in the cold air as Fordham booted the ball high and long for the kickoff. Marvin, of course, being the biggest and yet somehow fastest kid on the field, made the first tackle, sending a Xavier kid into a sideline tuba player. I patted Marvin's uncle in front of us on the back. Tuba players be warned, I said, smiling. We expect nothing less than the Bronx's version of Bo Jackson. Mr. Peters, who was almost as big as his nephew, gave out a bellowing laugh. The sweet old man had finally made it up from North Carolina to stay with Big Marv, who had moved out of the Bennett abode amid many teary goodbyes and hugs 2 days before. We were all going to miss the big galoot.
And remember, Mr. Peters, he's to play basketball at Manhattan College, Seamus said, patting the man's huge shoulder. Not Manhattanville, just plain old normal Catholic meat and potatoes Manhattan in Riverdale. Don't forget now.
Chapter 99. I was heading down the bleachers for the next round when I got the text from my good buddy Paul Ernenwein. "How's it hanging, Miss Oakley?" it said. "Rootin' tootin'," I texted back, laughing at our little inside joke. There had been a lot of hoopla about the shot that had dropped the assassin, especially the fact that he had been shot through the hand holding his rifle before he'd been killed. World-famous snipers had weighed in with glowing reviews of the shot's professionalism, which suggested years and years of training. The Post even did a detailed mock-up of it, where the chopper was, where I was, where Matthew LaRue was, a dotted line showing the trajectory of the bullet up 67th Street. I had to struggle to stifle my laughter every time I looked at the 100% wrong mock-up or read one of these lauding reviews. Because the whole thing, the famous world-class shot, was actually a complete accident. Before I was able to adjust my aim, the big, awkward Shytac rifle had slipped from where I'd placed it between the crenellations. Grabbing at it to keep it from falling, I'd hit the damn thing's hair trigger. Call it dumb blind luck, the hand of God. But I had nothing to do with shooting the Brit through his hand holding the rifle. Since I knew hoopla to be far more trouble than it's worth, I had actually insisted that LaRue had done it. After the shot, Matthew Joseph LaRue died right there on the roof as we were trying to get him back into the chopper. Crediting him was the least I could do for his poor family after all the sacrifices he had made for us. The Brit's real name, it turned out, was Andy Heathton. The FBI had sent a photo of the body to British intelligence, who had finally been able to ID the shooter. The 39-year-old professional killer had been born and raised in Leeds, England, and had been taught how to shoot by the British Royal Marines at age 21. Apparently, he had spent the next several years of his life as a mercenary, killing folks all over the world. His wife, Holly Heathton, 33, who was thought to be responsible for the remote-controlled dump truck that had rammed the motorcade, was caught by customs out at JFK trying to leave the country the night of the attempted assassination. "You hear?" Paul texted me a second later. "About what?" I texted back. "About the Times article," Paul said from behind me. I turned and stared at the red-headed Fed. "No," I said, "but something tells me I'm about to find out about it." "Come on," Paul said, patting me on the shoulder as he pocketed his phone. "Let's walk and talk." Chapter 100. "We arrested Secret Service Sac Margaret Foley late last night," Paul said, as we walked down a breezy drive past Fordham's beautiful old stone buildings.
"Is that right?"
"Yep. We got up on a phone we found in the shed of her house in Silver Spring. There were hundreds of calls between her and Mark Everard. Photos on there as well. Startling ones."
"Of an intimate nature?" I said.
"The most highly intimate. She'd been sleeping with him for years, apparently. They met down at the pile after 9/11.
"Love among the wreckage," I said. "Romantic."
"She finally broke last night," Paul said. "She had given Everard the president's route and itinerary, which he then passed along to the assassin through back channels. They'd been planning this for over a year."
"She happened to mention why she and Everard wanted to off their own country's leader? Nothing new on Netflix?"
"She said it was about Buckland's call to slice the federal budget to the bone and do a thorough audit of all the books, including Homeland Security. She said she had misappropriated a few dollars here and there over the years, and didn't want to wind up on the unemployment line or in jail."
"Wow. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't she have a family?"
"Yep, married, with 3 kids, Paul said.
"How do you go from skimming off the top at the Secret Service to planning your boss's funeral because there might be layoffs?" I said. "Are things really that corrupt, I wonder?
Or have we gotten to the point where we don't catch it anymore?
That's if you even buy that story, Paul said. Evrard was a spy, and I think like all spies, Evrard sold her and played her like an asset, used her own fears and desires to manipulate her. He needed the info she could access.
Too bad we can't ask him to confirm, huh? I said.
Evrard had hung himself with a tied-together pair of sneaker laces in his cell down at the Federal Detention Center in Lower Manhattan on the second night after his arrest. No one knew how the sneaker laces had gotten into his solitary confinement cell, but I wasn't worried because it was under investigation.
Why do you think Evrard did it? Was he a double agent? Hired by someone else?
Paul shrugged. He was hired by somebody, and my gut says not the Russian government. I think he just got the Russian mob involved in order to make it look like it was coming from Putin's direction, but it wasn't. It was just a smokescreen.
But who could fund an operation of this scale? I said. It would have to cost a pretty penny these days to assassinate a president. Who has that kind of juice?
Paul looked at me. You're right. The Brit didn't work cheap. I heard a rumor that he had a numbered account in the kind of Swiss bank they won't let you into the lobby of unless you're there to park eight figures. But don't forget, Evrard's been in the business a long time. He definitely had the connections.
Then he shrugged.
Buckland did mention he wanted to audit the Federal Reserve.
Ah, the central bankers, I said. That's true. Auditing them is probably something they don't want. Making money out of thin air must make it easy to fund an assassination. Let's face it, there isn't anything that's really too much of a problem for them with that kind of power.
True, Paul said. But perhaps it'll all come out in the congressional commission that's being assembled.
I stopped walking. A gust of cold wind blew up, hammering the trees as the branches cracked against one another like kids playing swords with broomsticks.
We'll never know, will we? I said after a beat. Just like JFK's assassination, we'll never know.
No, Mike, Paul said. I don't think we ever will. But look on the bright side. Whoever it was, we squashed them. We checked their shit. We could be going to a presidential funeral right now.
We stood our watch.
We did. All of us. You, me, Matt, your detective friends. Sometimes, it's all you can do.
Then I shook Paul's hand and turned on my heel and went back down the drive toward the cheers in the field. At this point, I was wise enough to no longer give a care. One day at a time and all that, and this one day was one of my favorites of the year. I wasn't about to waste one more second of it on work.
Chapter 101. And it's no, nay, never, no, nay, never, no more, Seamus sang as he played the accordion in the living room after the turkey was demolished. Turkeys, to be exact.
Well, how do you like Irish Thanksgiving? I said to Mr. Peters as I was stacking clean plates from the dining room table.
We also do an Irish Halloween and even, impossibly, an Irish 4th of July. Because nothing enhances a fireworks display like green beer and a hearty jig.
I like it just fine, Mr. Peter said, laughing and looking like he was ready for a long tryptophan nap.
That gravy Mary Catherine made was divine. And those biscuits, the southerner winked, rivaled my own mama's.
I smiled as I headed into the kitchen.
Mary Catherine had insisted we do Thanksgiving early for Marvin and his uncle, who were just settling into their new place. I dropped off the china next to Mary Catherine, who was rinsing a platter in the sink. I stood there looking at her for a second. She'd put her hair up, and she was smiling to herself about something, a memory, maybe a joke. She looked so incredibly beautiful and sweet as she stood there in her apron that I felt a physical pulse. An almost electric shock of happiness passed through me. It suddenly dawned on me then, like a name that's been on the tip of your tongue. I knew that I loved her and only her, and that I would never want anyone else but her for the rest of my days.
Yes, Michael, she said, suddenly hitting me with her blue smiling eyes. You look like you want to say something.
I said, smiling, stalling, blushing.
You what?
She said, turning, now face to face with me, pinning me with those eyes. I brought you my plate, I said, pointing at the counter.
So you did, so you did. A fine plate it is, too.
I hugged her then, fell into the nape of her neck, never wanted to stop falling.
You had my plate at hello, my Irish beauty, I whispered in her ear. Cross my plate and hope to die.
Please continue listening to hear an excerpt from James Patterson and Maxine Petro's Woman of God.
1. Vatican City. The story had begun deep inside the Vatican, had leaked out into the city of Rome, and within days had whipped around the globe with the momentum of a biblical prophecy. If true, it would transform not only the Roman Catholic Church, but all of Christianity, and possibly history. Today was Easter Sunday. The sun was bright, almost blinding, as it glanced off the ancient and sacred buildings of Vatican City. A tall, dark-haired man stood between towering statues on the colonnade, the overlook above St. Peter's Square. He wore Ray-Bans under the bill of his cap, a casual blue jacket, a denim shirt, workaday jeans, and combat boots. The press corps milled and chatted behind him. But writer Zachary Graham was transfixed by the hundreds of thousands of people packed together in the square below like one enormous single-cell organism. The sight both moved him and made him sick with worry. Terrifying, unprecedented events were happening around the world. Famines and floods and violent weather patterns, compounded by wars and other untethered forms of human destruction. The New York Times had flown Graham to Rome to cover Easter in the Vatican and what might be the last days in the life of an aging Pope Gregory XVII. The Pope was a kind and pious man, beloved everywhere. But since Graham's arrival in Rome 4 days ago, he had seen the sadness over the Pope's imminent passing, and not long after, his death eclipsed by a provocative rumor, which, if true, would be not just the turning point in one of the world's great religions and the explosion of a media bomb, but to Zachary Graham, a deeply personal event. Graham had been born in Minnesota 45 years before. He was the eldest son of a middle school teacher and a Baptist minister. He was no fan of organized religion, but he was fair-minded. He was a brilliant writer, highly respected by his peers, and clearly the right person for this job, which was why The Times, still the preeminent news machine of the 21st century, had sent him. Now, as he stood in the shadows of Bernini's massive statuary, watching the crowd show signs of panic, Graham knew it was time to go to ground. He walked 20 yards along the overlook, stopping at the small cage-like lift. Other reporters followed him, cramming themselves into the rickety elevator. The doors screeched shut. Graham pressed the down button, and the car jiggled and lurched toward the plaza below. From there, Graham walked north through the colonnade, the harsh light throwing contrasting blocks of sharp shadow onto the worn stones. Moving quickly, he exited through the shifting crowd in St. Peter's Square and headed toward an alley off Via della Conciliazione, where the mobile production trucks were behind barricades, tightly parked in a bumper-to-bumper scrum. Graham flashed his credentials to get through security, then opened one of the rear doors of a white panel van. He peered over a sound man's shoulder at the large monitor and read so many expressions on the faces in the crowd. Fear, desperation, and fervent hope that the new pope would bring much-needed change. From the election of the very first Vicar of Christ to the current Holy See, the pope had always been God's representative on earth. A man. Could it be true that Gregory's successor would be a woman? The provocative, unsettling story that had once been just a whisper was taking on more certainty by the moment. The next pope would be an American lay priest by the name of Bridget Fitzgerald. The possibility of a woman pope was extraordinary, astounding, and if it happened, the consequences would be profound. Zachary Graham had done his homework. Legend has it that in the year 855 AD, a woman who had disguised herself as a man was elected pope. 3 years later, while in a processional through Rome, this pope had gone into labor and given birth. She was immediately tied to the tail of a horse, dragged through the streets to her death. Her baby was also murdered, and the two of them were buried beneath the street where they died. Given the absence of physical artifacts, this story had been officially dismissed by the Catholic Church as a Protestant story concocted to embarrass the Church and the papacy. Yet there were etchings of Pope Joan and footnotes in 100 ancient illuminated manuscripts. There was even a small, disfigured shrine to Pope Joan on a small street not far from St. Peter's Square. This old story troubled Graham's soul. It was why he was afraid for Brigid when people spoke of her as miraculous, and why, for so long, he had been unable to find satisfaction, or love, or even sleep. Graham took a chair in front of the screen displaying those rapt, excited, tormented faces, and carefully considered his options. Should he wait, observe, and report the facts that were unfolding before him? Should he do his job? Or should he commit journalism's greatest sin by interfering in this true epic drama? If he did that, he might very well change the outcome. 2. Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was trying to get my 7-year-old, Gillian, ready for the day. She is a funny little girl, bratty and bright, and clever, and slippery. She's the apple, peach, and plum of my eye, and I love her to pieces. Thank you, God. It was Easter Sunday, and Gilly was in the closet trying on various articles of clothing, some of which were actually hers, and she was telling me about her dream.
I finally found out where the polar bears went.
Oh? So where did they go? She leaned out of the closet, showing me her darling face, her bouncing curls, and her bony shoulders. Gilly, you have to get dressed. Come on now.
They were on the moon, Mom. They were on the moon. And I was there. I had a special car with skis instead of wheels, and even though it was nighttime, it was so bright that I could see the bears everywhere. You know why they're on the moon?
Why? I said, lacing up my shoes.
Because the moon is made of ice. The ice covers the oceans of the moon.
People had been talking about colonizing the moon for the better part of 100 years. It was still an impossible hope, a total fantasy. But there it was every night, right up there, pristine, visible, and with historic human footprints still in the moon dust. And now Gilly's dreamed-up polar bears were not facing earthly extinction. They were partying on the moon. As Gilly, now back in the closet, told me,
"The man in the moon provided the bears with food and volleyball."
I laughed, thinking about that, and she said,
"I'm not kidding, Mom."
I was folding up the discarded clothes Gilly had flung all over the room when I heard her cry out for me.
"Honey, what is it? What?"
She came out of the closet showing me the blood coming from the web between her thumb and forefinger of her left hand. She still held a piece of broken light bulb.
"It just rolled off the shelf and broke.
Let me see." She showed me the glass with its sharp edges.
"No, silly. Show me your cut."
She held out her hand, and droplets of blood fell on the front of her chosen Easter dress, a froth of ruffled pink with an overskirt of spangled tulle. It was excruciating, the sweetness and the vulnerability of this little girl. I stifled my urge to cry and said, "Let's fix this, okay?" A few minutes later, Gilly's finger was washed and bandaged, the glass shards were in a box in the trash, and now I was focused again on the time. Gilly wriggled into her second-best dress, a blue one with a sash of embroidered daisies. "Gorgeous," I said. I stepped into my clean white surplice, and peering into a small mirror propped on the bookcase, I finger-combed my unruly ginger hair.
"You look beautiful, Mom," she said, wrapping her arms around my waist.
I grinned down at her.
"Thank you.
Now put on your shoes."
"We're not late, you know."
"Not yet, anyway." "Let's go, silly Gilly. Let's go." 3. I braced myself, Then Gilly and I stepped out onto the stoop. The shifting crowd filling the street roared. Communicants, neighbors, people who had come here to catch a glimpse of me. Ordinary people of every age and description reached out their hands, lifted their babies, and chanted my name. Bridget! Bridget! I'd seen this outpouring of passion before, and still I wasn't sure how to act. Sometimes the mood of a crowd turned dark. I'd seen that, too. Gilly said,
Mom, you'll be all right.
She waved, and the crowd went wild again. And then they pushed forward toward the stoop. News broadcasters, mega bloggers, televangelists, and entertainment TV hosts pointed their microphones toward me, asking, Bridget, are the rumors true? Have you gotten the call? Are you ready to go? I had answered their questions in the past, but was always asked for more. And by now, I didn't have any more. Gilly was too small to walk through this groundswell, so I hoisted her up, and with her arms around my neck and her legs around my waist, I stepped carefully down to the street where the crowd was at eye level. Hey, everyone, I said as I waded into the river of people. Beautiful Easter Sunday, isn't it? I would stop to talk, but we have to get going. We'll be late.
Just one question,
shouted Jason Beans, a reporter from the Boston Globe who liked to be called Papa. He was wearing a button on his lapel, the single letter Y, which stood for the all-inclusive, universal question about everything. The heat waves, the long frigid winters, the eerily brilliant sunsets, and ever-warming rising seas. Why?
We can walk and talk,
Beans was saying. He was standing between me and other reporters who were angling for their just one question. I kind of liked the somewhat annoying Jason Beans, but Gilly and I couldn't risk getting swallowed up by this crowd. We had to move.
Have you gotten the call from the Vatican?
Beans asked. Oh, Papa, it's a rumor, nothing more. And that's the really big scoop. Now please pardon me. I have to go to church. I have a mass to say.
Bridget! Bridget!
Flowers flew at me, and hands grabbed at my skirts, and Jason Bean stepped in front of us and wedged open a path. Gilly and I drafted behind him. We crossed the street, and there, mid-block, stood the homey brick church that had anchored this neighborhood for a century. People crowded us from all directions, calling out,
We love you, Bridget! Bridget, will you remember us when you're living in Rome?
I remember you right here and now, Luann. See you in church.
By the time we reached the entrance to St. Paul's, thousands were being funneled through the narrow streets toward the entrance, and they understood that only a few hundred would fit inside the small neighborhood church. The panic was starting. They all wanted to see me. Gilly was twisting in my arms, waving, laughing into the crook of my neck.
Mom, this is so great.
With Beans acting as the tip of the spear, I entered the sacristy with my daughter still in my arms. I thanked the reporter, who shot his last desperate questions at me. I told him, I'll see you after Mass, Papa, I promise, and closed the door. I let Gilly down, and she fed our pet tabby cat, Puppy. Then my little girl ran out to the nave and squeezed her way into a front pew. I crossed myself, and, hoping that I would find the right words, I walked out to the altar. The air was supercharged with expectation. I looped the stole around my neck and stepped up to the altar. But instead of beginning the Mass in the traditional manner, I spoke to the congregation in the most personal way I knew how.
That was a pretty rough scene out onto Wolf Street,
I said to the congregants. But I'm glad we're all together now on this momentous Easter Sunday. We have a lot to reflect upon, and much to pray for. A bearded man jumped to his feet at the rear of the church and called my name, demanding my attention.
Look here, Bridget. Look at me.
Did I know him? I couldn't make out his face from where I stood, but then he walked up the aisle, crossed himself, and slipped his hand into his jacket. In front of me, Gilly shouted,
Mom!
Her face contorted in fear. But before I could speak to my precious daughter, I heard a cracking sound and felt a punch to my shoulder. I reached my hand out to Gilly. There was another crack,
and I staggered back and grabbed at the altar cloth, pulling it and everything on the altar down around me. I fought hard to stay in the present. I tried to get to my feet, but I was powerless. The light dimmed, the screams faded, and I was dropping down into a bottomless blackness, and I couldn't break my fall.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Bullseye, written by James Patterson and Michael Ledwidge, read by Danny Mastrogiorgio, produced and directed by Cheryl Smith, recorded by Charles McCrory, post-production by Beat Street Productions. Bullseye is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by James Patterson. Woman of God excerpt copyright 2016 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2016 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook, without permission, is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.